Welcome to Voices from ASCO, Conversations in Oncology. I'm your host, Kristen Siahian. This podcast series brings you insightful discussions with leaders from across the oncology landscape. Together, we'll explore the latest advancements, challenges, and opportunities shaping cancer care and research today. Let's dive in. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome Mema Carmo. Mema is the founder and CEO of the Tiger Lily Foundation and a 20-year triple-negative breast cancer survivor. She has an incredibly inspiring story of resilience, hope, and purpose. You won't want to miss this powerful conversation. Okay, well, welcome. I'd like to welcome my listeners back to Voices from ASCO, Conversations in Oncology. I'm Kristen Siahian. I'm the VP of Branded Channels here at Amplity, and it is my honor and pleasure to introduce to you my friend Mema Carmo. Hi, Mema.
Hi, Kristen. It's good to be here.
Welcome.
See you and finally meet in person after all this time.
After all these years. The first thing I would like to do is read to you your LinkedIn description. I love this. Mema declares herself a rock star, a healthcare strategist, a transformative keynote speaker, philanthropist, manifester, change agent, unicorn, patient whisperer, and lover of life.
And you forgot badass. Is that
and there? A badass.
Yes.
It's so true. And I have to say, when I read that, having gotten to know you over the years, I agree with all of those statements.
Thank you, my friend.
You're really doing amazing work in the world.
Thank you.
But above all of that, she is the founder and CEO of Tiger Lily Foundation. Would you just like to give us a brief background on Tiger Lily?
How much time do I have?
That's a great question, as you want.
So Tiger Lily is my baby. So I found a tumor in my breast, a lump in my breast at 31 years old. And went to my doctors, and they told me that I was too young to have breast cancer to come back when I was older. All the guidelines said, you know, USPSTF, NCCN, ACS, that women tend to get breast cancer around 50. So I was way beneath that age. I didn't have any family history, so I was kind of blown off and dismissed for months. I had to push for a mammogram, first of all. Got a mammogram. It came back clean. But I had to push and wait for that, like push for months. Finally got it. It came back clean. And they said, we told you so. You don't have breast cancer. You're too young. And so, you know, I had all these guidelines by these people that were much smarter than I was. And I had this technology telling me that I couldn't have cancer. But I felt this lump that was growing in my body. And I was getting night sweats and tired, fatigue. So I kept pushing for an aspiration, finally got that. After months of pushing for that as well, the lump wasn't aspirating. So I asked for a biopsy and asked again and again. Finally, I got a biopsy. It turned out I had triple negative breast cancer, stage 2B. And at the time, there was no treatment targeting TNBC. So although I knew my body enough to check my breast at that age in the first place, I had a doctor, a healthcare team, I had, you know, insurance, I had all the things. I was still dismissed and delayed in the diagnosis. And they said to me, you have triple negative breast cancer. And, you know, I read the statistics about it and it was very aggressive. And they said, we can't treat you with anything that's targeting your subtype. And I'm like, what does that mean? They're like, well, we don't have anything for you really. We think whatever we have, but we don't really have anything to treat your disease. And I'm like, what does that even mean? I didn't know what those things meant, but I realized quickly that I was like a sitting duck, you know. It was terrifying. My daughter was only 3 years old. So I just, you know, prayed to God. I began treatment. I said, well, give me whatever you have. So I had surgery and then I had chemo, and I was very sick. I remember thinking, like, I cannot do this. I was so sick. I remember having like diarrhea, rashes, night sweats, like headaches, nausea, vomiting, and I have to take care of a baby, right? And work. And I was like, you know, you always think, like, I'm very much of a mind over matter person. I'm so strong-minded. And I'm like, I'll get through this. I have, like, long hair. I'm like, my hair won't come out. I'm going to, like, badass this. I'm going to, like, kick cancer's ass. But then that medicine just knocks you down on your knees. And so I was literally in the shower one day on my knees crying to God. Like, I cannot. My body was, like, falling. Like, it was just falling apart. And then I said, I went to bed that night so angry. I'm like, how can this happen to me? I'm a good person. I do charity work. I don't hurt anybody. Like, why? And the answer I got was like, why not? People get cancer that don't deserve to get cancer. And so it was kind of like, what are you going to do about it? And so I went to bed mad at God that night, and I, you know, So what can I do to ensure that nobody else goes through what I go through? If I don't, however long I'm living for, make this not in vain. And the next morning I got up and I heard this voice in my head saying, Tiger Lily. I'm like, what the F is that? And I just thought, I just felt different. I was like, you know when you pray to God about something and he actually shows up? So I was like, okay, so this actually does happen. People can pray to God and feel God. I felt like my mind was like racing with ideas, and I was like, oh my God. I began to write stuff down, and I got on the computer. I began to like put everything down on paper. Yeah. And so I began to, that thing became Tiger Lily Foundation. And the next few days I felt better. I went to Office Depot and I got those big, like a post-it paper and put them on the wall and taped everything up. And then I began to like vision board what I was seeing in my head and feeling in my heart. And that is now manifested over the past almost 20 years.
It's incredible. And the work you've done in the advocacy space is so just inspirational, aspirational. I really admire you for everything you've done.
Thank you. It's about love. It's all really love. Is. And so when I got diagnosed and I realized, like, however time I have, how do I make that time intentional? So Tiger Lily has been all about giving patients a loving, safe, heart-centered place to come to.
Love it.
And make magic happen during and after their cancer journey.
Well, you are certainly doing that. And one of the programs you and I have worked on a bit together is your Angel Advocacy Program. It really is an incredible program. So can you tell us, just top line it for me, tell me what the Angel Advocacy Program is and tell me how many angels you have so far.
So the Angel Advocate Program, you know I love acronyms. I love beautiful things. So all of our programs are like Angel, Heal, Power,
yes.
Raise. Everything we do is about the energy of love and heart-centeredness. So in the angel word, the word stands for advocate now to grow, be empowered in need. Patients come to us as a patient that's going through cancer treatment. We help them. We put through this program called the Angel Advocacy Training Program. It has 15 modules, 6 are mandatory. They learn that their journey is not in vain, that their life can be used for a bigger purpose and something more beautiful than they could imagine. They can create a legacy of health for their families and their children, and one that will live on beyond them. And so they learn to use their story in a way that can create passion and purpose and inspire other people. So they learn about storytelling. They learn about advocacy, breast cancer, all the things, screening, testing, biomarkers, clinical trials, policy. And then once they get trained, we give them opportunities to go out there and use their voices. And so a patient that comes to us like overwhelmed and scared is then turned into this fearless warrior that can utilize her voice. And then they get to work on amazing campaigns with sponsors for clinical trials. They get to go in their community and utilize their relationships to build in their connections about healthcare and breast care. And all the things, you know, and change policy that can impact people's lives.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Another really wonderful just feature of your program is kind of a special emphasis on Black and brown women, social determinants of health, disparities in healthcare. Do you want to talk to that just a little bit and how Tiger Lily is addressing that?
Yeah, you know, much like my story, when I found the tumor, like, no one told me that Black women tend to get breast cancer that's more aggressive, like triple negative breast cancer.
Right.
No one told me that women who look like me die almost twice the rate as women who are white from breast cancer treatment. No one told me that the reason why they may not have had treatment targeting triple negative is because they weren't enrolling women who look like me in clinical trials. And it's funny, when I finally realized, the women that they showed in those campaigns, women who were white and older. And so they were not younger, and they were not of any color that looked remotely like my color. So I didn't know that, you know, this disparity. Like, I found my own luck. I went to a doctor. I got dismissed, delayed, denied. And the delay could have cost me my life. And if I had taken their advice, I would have been dead years ago. And then we learn about, you know, bias in healthcare and racism in healthcare. And even when I was in treatment and I remember I would break out into hives after having one of my treatments, and I would like itch for hours. And I called the nurse, the navigator, and she said, take Benadryl. I did already. I took two. Take two more. And I would take something like 7 Benadryls, and I would be itching for hours.
Yeah.
And then so at some point, I'm like, I don't want to be on the medication anymore. I can't live like this. And I didn't know that. And I called and she said, nobody else has had these side effects except you that I know of. And so during COVID, I was on a call with some other advocates, angel advocates, and we're talking, they're all Black women. And I said, you know, we're talking about people who didn't adhere to, or why would we not adhere. And I said, well, it's not that we don't want to hear, but here's my experience in treatment. And then literally people, like, all these women said, me too. They had the same experience with the itching and the rash and the hives.
Interesting.
And what I surmise is that they may not have probably been in a trial either of those drugs. So people say that women who are black and brown don't adhere or don't do whatever. It's like, well, maybe we were in the trial, so we don't, those side effects were not evident that we would know to even address them or be told that we could have them. So I'm trying to change the discourse to, from people who are black and brown don't listen or don't adhere or aren't literate. I'm freaking literate, but I mean, if you don't talk to me, I don't understand. I'm not gonna know if you're addressing this hot topic impacts me, first of all. But so the black women tend to have, again, barriers. Maybe we learn there's redlining still in place. So those, the redlining from back in the day still exists. So the hospitals that are getting the more funding are the ones that are not in those areas. And so people even...
Define redlining for me.
Well, the redlining is where they kind of have the map of where people who are black needed to live. So people who were of color could not go, they couldn't live in certain communities. They had a map, like you don't, they have to live here and they can't live there. And so that redlining meant people who were in the white communities got the nicer schools and the better hospitals. And even some communities that are black and brown, they tend to dump waste and trash in those communities. So the water is poisonous. So there's so many things that impact. They have more, you know, they don't have the, you have more Wendy's and McDonald's and less Whole Foods, things like that. And I have some friends of mine who are in communities where they don't have a gym if they want to go to a gym. So there's, those things are still in place today in certain communities, even in DC, the communities that are still underserved in the nation's capital because of this, of what happened in the past. Those red lines exist, but they're invisible. And those, and the, I'm sure you've heard the phrase that people's zip code can determine their outcome. And it's still happening today. But what is even worse with people, with this whole racism and healthcare thing and how it's still existing is that even if you are not in a community that's underrepresented, because of the, your skin color and how you present, you still might get that same treatment. Because I did have an issue one day where I did have, I have histamine issues and I had lung scarring from treatment. And so I have allergies and asthma and all kinds of things. And I ended up eating something and I broke into a full, I had an anaphylactic reaction. So my daughter took me to the hospital, to the emergency room, and they were demanding my paperwork as my throat was closing up. They were like, give me your, and she's like, she's going to die. She can't breathe because I lost my EpiPen. So I hadn't had an attack for a long time. So I finally get back there and they gave me the medication and my body calmed down. After a few minutes, it began to flare up again. So they told me they couldn't let me go home until the next morning. They wanted to watch me because I could have had it in my sleep and choked to death, right? Yeah. So a doctor comes in, and when I'm admitted, he's like, well, I have to ask you some questions. And he's like, are you a drug addict or alcoholic? And I was like, what? He's like, well, why do you need two EpiPens and Benadryl to be, like, what? So he was assuming that I was...
The first question
he asked me. I literally started, I was so... First of all, I was so fragile. I had almost choked to death. And my skin was covered in, like, I was itching and I was inflamed. And I was, like, just emotional from trying to just get... It was like a couple hours of getting my body to calm down. And my daughter was sitting there looking at the man. And I was just like, I just was like so shocked. And I didn't know what to say to him. He's like, ma'am. And she said, mommy, tell him who you are. And I said, I shouldn't have to tell him who I am. You know, and the nurse was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so embarrassed. And she pulled him out of the room. But I just sat there thinking, this man assumes that because I had this reaction that I must be a drug addict. Not only am I the healthiest person that you know, but I'm who I am in this space. Yes. And I was just like, and we're living, I live in a county called Loudoun County. Mm. It is one of the three highest, richest per capita income counties in the country. The hospital, my home and the hospital are less than 5 minutes apart. This is the kind of, I have access.
Yes.
This is what I'm getting in healthcare. So people that live in communities that are even more diverse and that have less access, the things that they experience are horrible. I have people that have to, like, you know, get dismissed by a doctor and they're metastatic and or they don't get calls back and they have to, like, go to a new hospital, travel to get treatment. It's just the stories are unbearable. And people who look like me die every day because of these very issues.
There are just no words for that. And it's heartbreaking. And there needs to be a lot of words around that to change it. So
Well, I mean, I go back to love, right? Like when babies are born, you know, two babies, black or white, they don't know color.
They don't know.
they don't know. They're taught that. They're taught you're different. They're taught I'm better. They're taught that you're different. You're less than me. And even if you're not taught that at birth, you're taught that fear over your adulthood. But I think I think after the recent election, I'll be honest, I felt for the first time I realized what being Black in America means fully. Because I felt the venom from people that looked at me, because they were able to look at me openly with venom before they had to hide it. And people were sending texts to Black women that were very nasty and saying things. And I'm like, I didn't want to leave my house for a week. Day after the election, I got invited to this event. It was a business event, a fundraiser, but it was put on by white business leaders, mostly men. It was like a prayer breakfast, but for the first time, the color of my skin led me to not go to an event. I just didn't feel like I'd be safe in that space. People would be looking at me like, because people had this smug look on their face, and somebody on my staff went to the gym that same day, and people were like, she walked into the gym, people were talking about like, we got those effing, you know, like the word. And she, people that she knew, and then she turned around like, what? Like, and they saw her and they got so embarrassed because they were caught. But that's the hostility we were facing as people.
I am so sorry.
I mean, it took me until now, we're in June, but I thank you. But like, I was like, I cannot comprehend raising my daughter in this world. And she's biracial. People actually were like, oh, you think you're, you know, like it was all of that. Like, and I was like, what is happening? And that pain of people, like the vitriol that was coming out against Black people and Black women, like Kamala, and people were just like, we effed them. And it was just all this stuff. And I was like, I don't know that I can do this. I don't know. I had to like pause and like, I cried. I was on my couch and I just was like, a lot of other people, women, Black women, we just talked and texted. And finally I realized that the world needs me to show up as me.
100%.
So I had to take care of myself, give myself love and care. And now I'm just pouring out pure love because the world needs. But to my earlier point, people are taught to be hateful. And so I can either let that hate make me back off my work and say I'm going to go do something different, or I can pour more love into the world.
Yeah.
And so I give myself a lot more love and self-care, but I'm just going to do what I do best, is love.
And you are so good at it, and I'm so happy to have you as a partner. My work that I've done as an editorial director for Conquer and for JOHNS, the Journal of Oncology Navigation
and Survivorship.
You're amazing,
Kristen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A lot of the work we do is about removing barriers to care for anyone that needs it. If it's a education barrier, if it's a transportation barrier, if it's you name it, we're addressing it. And part of that is around this concept of social determinants of health. Part of it is around your zip code should not
determine
the care you get.
Yeah.
It should be your genetic code. So I'm very happy to have a partner like you who helps us.
You're amazing.
Spread
and
that
I love
message.
having the space to share my voice in JOHNS as well and Conquer. And you've been an amazing partner.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to part one of my conversation with Mae McCarmo. I hope you'll join us for part two, coming up next on Voices from ASCO, Conversations in Oncology.